Initiate Cowrat Podcast.
I watched a YouTube video that talked about the history and the kind of the story of the hymn When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. I knew I'd heard of that hymn, and I knew I'd heard it, but I didn't remember it that much.
Yeah.
But I thought that the video looked interesting when it popped up in my feed. So it kind of relates to what we were talking about in the music episode, talking about what songs are appropriate for a worship service. And so I thought this was interesting. According to this video, the guy said that when he wrote this hymn and then presented it to the congregation, or however they do it, did it back then, introducing a new hymn or song, it was controversial. A lot of people didn't like it.
Okay.
So it was, he wrote it or published it, whatever, in 1707.
Wow.
So I just wanted to quick, I don't know if these are all the verses, but there's four verses that I found here on a Google search. I just want to read them real quick. It's not that long. So see if you can figure out why would this be controversial. When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss, and pour contempt on all my pride. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast, save in the death of Christ my God. All the vain things that charm me most, I sacrifice them through his blood. See from his head, his hands, his feet, sorrow and love flow mingled down. Did e'er such love and sorrow meet, or thorns compose so rich a crown? Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my all. So why would that be controversial?
Prince instead of king?
Nope.
Wow, I got nothing then.
It was too self-centered, some people thought. He uses the word I several times.
Yeah, and we did talk exactly about that.
Right. When I survey the wondrous cross, I count it but loss. Forbid it, Lord, that I should boast.
Right.
But a lot of these are like, you can see they're straight from scripture. You know, I count but loss, you know, whatever.
Yeah, Paul says that.
Yeah. Forbid it that I should boast in anything but Christ. You know, Paul says that also. And that made me think that I didn't do it yet, but I kind of want to do some research. Like, okay, what hymns were they singing then? I kind of want to compare, like, because, like, I wouldn't consider this a self-centered song.
Yeah.
But I can see why, because he's singing about what he thinks, I guess.
Right.
You know, if I say God is great, or if I say I think God is great, like, okay, there's a slight difference, but.
Right.
Kind of mean the same thing.
It's if you take it as kind of a, like, it's just him in the room singing that to God, like that's his confession and his profession to him. It's like, that makes perfect sense. I mean, to say God, I just acknowledge, like, I got nothing.
Right.
I got nothing, and you are above and beyond all and in all and everything.
So anyway, that was my point. I thought it was so bizarre that the first point that I noticed was, you know, that even back then they thought something like that was too self-centered.
Yeah, and we, yeah.
But the other thing is that, again, even back then, people were like, what is this new stuff? We want the original, the old stuff. And this is a, what, 200-year-old hymn now?
300.
300?
Almost.
Or am I way off on my math here? 400?
17 what?
1707.
Yeah, 317 years.
Right. So I guess even back then, again, people didn't want something new.
Capitalize on the me. It's about him, yes.
Right. So me and my boys went and saw Weird Al live. He came to town a year and a half ago, something like that. And he had, the guy who opened for him was a comedian, not a musician.
Yep.
His name is Emo. He was in the movie UHF, which Weird Al did in the 70s, I think.
Right.
But I've never seen him anywhere else other than in this movie, apparently. He's a comedian.
Yeah.
Stand-up comedian that has his own thing going, but he was super funny. But I noticed he did a lot of jokes that were on the topic of, like, religion and Christianity.
Yeah.
Which just made me wonder, like, is he a Christian? And this is his way of kind of...
and they weren't
like safely bringing it up. I don't know. He didn't like preach the gospel or anything.
Right. But he also wasn't like scoffing.
Correct. Right. He wasn't making fun of Christianity per se. So one of his jokes I thought was funny, so I wanted to mention it here. He said, when I was young, I learned a lot of things about God and some things were confusing and I wasn't sure, like, how does God work? How do you pray? How do you get things from God, you know? And somebody told me that if you just pray with confidence, God will give you what you ask for. And so I prayed, God, give me a brand new bike. I want it to be a Schwinn. I want it to be red. And I want it to be at the end of my driveway tomorrow morning by 10 a.m. or 8 a.m., something like, whatever, when I wake up.
Yeah.
And so I went to sleep, woke up, looked at the end of the driveway. It wasn't there. I'm like, okay, I guess that's wrong. But then I remembered there's another thing that I know that you can always ask God for and always get it. So I stole a bike and then asked him for forgiveness.
Right.
So I came in the room and my kids were watching a YouTube video, this guy fixing up an old truck. I stood there watching for a minute and my 12-year-old paused and goes, Dad, this guy is fixing up a truck that's been sitting since the 1990s. And without thinking about it, I just automatically said, that's not that long ago.
Right.
I mean, for a truck it is, but that just came out of my mouth. And he says, Dad, you've been sitting since the 1990s.
Oh, yeah.
Did God save us because we are valuable, or are we valuable because God saved us?
Right.
I've heard this discussion online, like in some YouTube videos, and people have discussed it on Facebook and groups that I'm in. And when people say, well, we must be like really valuable, otherwise why would God die for us? Why would he go through any effort to get us back or to whatever, mm-hmm. or to have a relationship with if we weren't intrinsically valuable?
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, I guess. On the other hand, and me, I feel like that's a little self-focused. That's a little like we wouldn't exist without God. God made us from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We were his idea. And so any value that is in us came from God anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And God isn't like us where he goes around looking for things of value because he doesn't have them
right.
and wants them.
Right. And he's somehow insecure and he needs, yeah.
No. Yeah. Right. Like we're that way because we aren't the source of everything.
Right. Exactly.
God has made us and then he made some things and that for us to enjoy or to have, you know, that we find valuable. I mean, ultimately, we should all value comes from God. So.
Right.
But then I heard somebody ask that question that way, like, or they didn't ask the question. They said, God didn't pursue us because we're valuable. We're valuable simply because he made us.
He made us, yeah.
Right, yeah.
There is value on us, but only because he put it on us because he made us.
Right,
he has,
right.
I meant to look up the name of that song, but we've sung it many times. He has compassion on all that he has made.
Right, right.
And he has compassion on because he has made it. And we have value because he put value on us because he made us. That makes us valuable only because of his worth. So I would answer the question, he saved us because we're valuable, but we're valuable only because he made us.
Right, right. There's other verses, but this is the only one I have that had come up in one thing that I saw. So Romans 3, I'll start in verse 9. What shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? No, not at all. For we have already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are under the power of sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, no, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good, no, not even one. So at least in one sense, we are worthless.
Right.
And I say in at least in one sense. Again, like we said, if God values us, surely he knows whether we have some value.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And I heard it put, the way that humans determine the value of something, like if you say, like, how much is a car worth? It's worth what someone is willing to pay.
Right.
If there's a guy out there who's willing to pay $10,000 for this car, even if nobody else really wants it, then that car is worth $10,000.
Right.
So, well, is the car intrinsically worth $10,000? Or does the guy who's got the $10,000, is he causing it to be worth $10,000?
Right.
You know, if I know a guy who wants to pay $10,000 for the car, and I think the car's garbage, but I've found it for sale for $5,000, if the situation worked out right, there's no decision. I would buy it because I know that I can double my money by selling it.
Right.
Because I know it's, quote unquote, worth $10,000.
That's kind of the very crux of collectors right there is it's worth what somebody will pay for it.
Right, right.
And you put some on eBay and you'll find out sometimes. Sometimes what something's worth. It might take you a couple tries to...
Yeah.
It all depends on who has you watching at that moment and how well written your description is, if the right keywords pop up for their searches they've got set up. But yes.
Yeah. No, obviously, yeah, the practicality of finding the guy and letting him know you have it and whatever.
People are also very often deluded as well. Well, this is worth XYZ. Well, good luck finding that guy that'll pay that.
Right. Yeah. Like Dave Ramsey says, people have feelings about how much their house is worth. Like,
yeah.
That doesn't matter. If you're trying to sell it, it's worth what it's worth.
The market just determines that, not your feelings. Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
Yeah. Or I remember Grace came home one time. I don't know. She was probably 13 years old or something. And her and a friend walked over to a garage sale a couple blocks away. And they came home with a bag of Beanie Babies. Oh, they were going to get rich. Oh, somebody told them that Beanie Babies are worth a lot of money.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm thinking like, yeah, that was a long time ago that people fell for that one. I was shocked that someone was still saying it.
Like, right. That's like, so why aren't you charging more then? Exactly. That's how this logic works.
Yeah, right.
Wow. So it has compassion on all he has made. So first of all, the song is a vineyard song. I think the title is Bless the Lord, O My Soul. But it comes from Psalm 145, so I'll just read that quick. I will extol you, my God, O King, and I will bless your name forever and ever. Every day I will bless you, and I will praise your name forever and ever. There's that repetition. Great is the Lord, and greatly to be praised. And his greatness is unsearchable. One generation shall praise your works to another, and you shall declare your mighty acts. I will meditate on the glorious splendor of your majesty and on your wondrous works. Men shall speak of the might of your awesome acts, and I will declare your greatness. They shall utter the memory of your great goodness and shall sing of your righteousness. So verse 8, we get into it. The Lord is gracious and full of compassion, slow to anger and great in mercy. The Lord is good to all, and his tender mercies are over all his works. All your works shall praise you, O Lord, and your saints shall bless you. That takes us up to verse 10. So there's the psalm that the song is based on, and that's the song. But he has compassion in all he has made. Every time we sing that, I fall to pieces thinking about he does, and he has to. Otherwise, he'd have just scrapped the whole thing from the beginning.
Right,
they screwed up the first time. It's like, okay, this is a bad idea. This just is not going to work if he did not have compassion.
And even for me, it's a bit of a struggle sometimes to think like, okay, well, if God has compassion on all that he has made, why is there so much stinking suffering?
Yeah,
God just allows to happen.
Yeah.
Or preordains, if you want to talk to the Calvinist. Either way, as we've said before, like there's nothing outside of God stopping him from removing suffering from someone's life.
Right.
He can easily do it.
Yep.
I feel the weight of the atheist's question, why the heck does God allow so much suffering then?
Yeah.
If he's so good.
Right.
I mean, the one answer that to me is like undeniable is like he's made a way
right
for you to have eternal life. That's not on him if you reject it.
Right.
Yes, I still feel this sense of like, well, if I were God, I wouldn't allow people to get raped and murdered and starved to death and have their stuff stolen and tortured and whatever, you know, things that go on. You know, and we've talked about this kind of thing before. God has used, I know he's used my suffering, and compared to most people in the world, this very, very light and momentary afflictions that
have
come upon me in my life that I have nothing to complain about, really. you know, things that I struggled with for years and years and years. And I could be very tempted to look back and be like, why did you let me struggle so long? Why didn't you just fix it? Like,
yeah. Part of the human condition is a lot of times we won't take somebody else's word for something, no matter what it is, no matter how dramatic it is. They tell us, oh, well, don't do that because that'll go bad. People still got to do it. Kids got to do it. Kids don't take you seriously and totally believe every word you say when you tell them, if you go down that road, there's nothing but sadness and destruction.
Right.
So it's the same with God. It's like he kind of laid the whole thing out. It's like, but people still, they live like they don't believe him. So the crux of being human is what it takes to bring us to a place of believing. Because we're not prone to do that. We assume we know better. We don't. Rarely do we assume somebody else knows better on a lot of things, especially when it counters something that we think we want. So,
right.
What else is God going to do with that? If he wants you to have genuine faith in him, then you have to genuinely come to the place of believing that he is. Not just taking somebody else's word for it.
Right. As we've said before, I know I said this on a previous episode, I forget who said it, but somebody asked an atheist, what kind of evidence would it take for you to believe that God exists?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and he said, you know, if I saw Jesus rise from the grave right in front of my eyes and tell me to believe in him,
I would assume I was hallucinating.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so, yeah, it's not about the evidence.
No.
Oh, that brings up something that else. I forget if I've mentioned it to you like at church or at a breakfast or something already, but I thought this was really good. So the opposite question was asked of Mike Winger. It's just, it's never crossed my mind that you could turn this question around. At the atheist could ask a Christian, if someone came to you and brought undeniable evidence and proof that there's no God, would you follow the evidence and conclude that there's no God? Would you give up your faith and belief in God if the evidence, undeniable evidence, led you there?
Right. The problem with that proposition is that you can't prove the non-existence of something.
Well, that's one part of it. That's not where he went at all. I was really like, oh, okay, I wonder how he's going
to
answer
this. Because you can't be everywhere in the entire universe simultaneously to be able to see, yep, don't see it here.
Right, right.
Anyway, so what did he say?
Essentially, the way he answered this isn't quite word for word. He said, so I'm sitting there minding my own business, and a guy comes up to me, a guy with an intelligent mind who can think and speak and communicate to my intelligent mind, and he shows me evidence of something. And I take that evidence and I think about it with my intelligent mind and I ponder it and I use logic. Would I believe the evidence of, it doesn't matter what the evidence for, everything I've mentioned is evidence for God. This whole conversation can't even happen if God doesn't exist.
Right.
It's like, I know the atheists don't see it that way.
Right.
But when I look around, everything I see is evidence for God.
Yeah.
If you're trying to communicate with me, that's evidence for God.
Yeah.
The fact that you exist is evidence for God. If you bring me something to look at, that's evidence for God.
Yeah.
If you want me to read a paper written by a person, that's evidence for God.
Right.
Like, and he said, if the entire universe was just one molecule, and the, if a molecule existed, that's evidence for God. So I want to say yes, if the evidence led me to believe that there's no God, then I would believe there's no God. But evidence of anything existing is evidence for God.
Right.
Like nothing exists without God.
Right.
It's like, again, I know that that doesn't make any sense to the atheists, at least the way they say that they believe. But I reject the way you think about these things. So.
Yep. Because it does come down to belief, which is, so Hebrews 11 gives us a big mouthful of the whole issue of faith and that it's impossible to please him without having faith. So the bottom line is that we must believe. So Hebrews 11:5, we'll just start there. By faith, Enoch was taken away so that he did not see death and was not found because God had taken him. For before he was taken, he had this testimony that he pleased God. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So Hebrews 11, talking about faith over and over again, that the bottom line is, you have to believe that he is. And that is how we please him. And Jesus said, when I return, will I find faith on the earth? That's the bottom line for to believe in something that very, very, very few have ever physically seen any kind of representation of. In order to believe that he is, in order for that proposition to seem legitimate to you, you have to believe in something you cannot see. And Jesus said the disciples were blessed because they have seen and believe, but blessed are those who have not seen yet believe.
Right. My dad one time said, and I don't know if this guy, I think it was a pastor that my dad was talking to, questioning whether what this guy was saying was something about the Bible or Christianity. And the guy essentially said, well, I said it. Isn't that good enough?
Yeah, like, yeah, well,
okay.
And you are who?
Yeah, right, exactly. Something I thought of, I didn't have it in my notes and I didn't send you. Our friend Jim, who was in one of our episodes, took issue with something I said. So I want to bring it up and respond on the show. we talked about it in person, yeah, so I already responded. But I thought he made a good point. So I said, Jesus prayed, let this cup pass from me, not my will, but yours be done. And the cup did not pass. He had to drink the cup, though, that he was asking God, if there be any other way, let this cup pass from me. And so what I had said was, Jesus didn't get what he wanted.
Right, right.
And so Jim said, wait a minute, wait a minute. When, I forget, was it Peter who said, may it never be that when Jesus said, I have to die, he said, get behind me, Satan. It's like, he knew that he was going to the cross. He knew that he was going to die, and he was determined to do it. He wasn't going to let people stop him or talk him out of it or whatever.
Yep.
Anyway, so Jim's issue was like, so did he really not want to go to the cross? And so, like, okay, yes, good point. Jesus is God. God knows everything. This was planned from before the foundation of the world.
Yep.
Jesus signed up to go to the cross before the sin problem even existed. This was all planned out. So it's not as if Jesus was unwillingly going to the cross.
His flesh was just squirming a little bit. He's
exactly.
I really don't. This is going to be tough.
Right, yeah. So I guess I would rephrase it. I wouldn't say Jesus didn't get what he wanted. I would say he didn't get what he was asking for in that prayer.
Right.
Yeah.
Although in one sense, since he kind of says, but not what I want, but what you want.
Right.
You can maybe see he did, because he's like, he said that the most important thing to me is what you want, Father.
Right, right.
And that is what he got. But
yes. I would say, though, like when I prayed for something and say, God, please, but your will, but I still want
I'm hoping it's your will that I get what I'm wanting here.
Right. Right, yeah. Again, in this is the Trinity. You have to bring up the Trinity. Like, how can...
Right.
Three persons talk to each other, and one guy does this, and the other guy's like, well, since you did, you know, Jesus said, well, I do only what my Father does, like, and he prays to the Father, so they're two separate persons,
right?
Yet they're in agreement. Yep. There's no disunity or disagreement in the Trinity.
Right.
How does this make sense? I don't know.
Right.
I'm not God. I don't get it.
Exactly. We're only human. It would be a small religion if we could think we had everything figured out. Right. That's not a God religion.
Right. Yeah.
Not a faith in God, because if he's not any smarter than the best of us can manage together, then we're in trouble.
Right. Let's throw out everything that we don't understand so that all of our doctrine is something that we can understand.
Michael Card had a song to that effect. We made you in our image, so our faith's idolatry.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, once a week observant where we coldly mouth your words. Present reality. That's the name of that song. Check it out.
There was a documentary that Linda and I watched. There's two of them. It's called American Gospel. There's a one, and then there's a second one. We had watched the first one a little while back. And they're interviewing several, like, progressive, quote-unquote, Christians. Mm-hmm. I say, quote-unquote, because I think if you're progressive Christianity, you're not really a Christian.
You're kind of an oxymoron.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you can be caught up in that way of thinking and be confused and not know, you know, and still be a Christian.
Right.
You can be influenced by all kinds of lies and confusion. I'll say I'm a Christian and I don't think I have everything right yet.
Right.
I'm sure I'm in error on something. Problem is everybody thinks that they're right. So
right.
But anyway, the point is they interviewed a bunch of these guys who have all this, what I would call bizarre Christian theology, and they try to use the Bible to support it, and they twist stuff or they just toss out parts of the Bible, like, well, they didn't know back then, we're smarter now, you know,
that
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So he started out as he was a Christian. He was young, grew up, I think his dad was a pastor, I can't remember, but he was like super, like, go to church twice a week minimum every week of his entire life. You know, he's read the Bible, he loved worshiping and songs and whatever. And then as he got older, he started changing his beliefs a little bit and like, okay, well, maybe the church was wrong at this point in history and all, whatever, just getting more and more into this progressive Christianity. So he started changing his theology. So the point I'm trying to make, he said that it finally dawned on him that he kept changing his beliefs about God so much to fit his own preferences that it finally hit him like, I'm making up my own God completely.
Mm-hmm.
What he thought he was doing was believing the God of the Bible and then just tweaking some things here and there that he thought he was wrong about.
Right.
But he tweaked and tweaked so much that he finally realized, like, I've completely gotten rid of the God of the Bible and made up a God that I like. And this God is just like me. Everything that I like, this God likes. And everything that I do, this God approves of. So what did he do? He decided there is no God. And he became an atheist.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Right. You thought that it was going the other way, that he finally realized.
What have I been doing? Obviously, yeah. Yeah, well, that's the one of two options when you get to that point, when you see that, yeah.
Right, yeah. His thought was like, if I can just making up my own God, then is this God even real? I guess there is no God. And so he just went into humanism. And
yeah.
I guess kudos for being honest and just calling it what it is out loud and taking it to its logical conclusion, I guess.
Yeah. Also a cautionary tale. It's like even the devil can use what's actually true to con you into just giving up on it.
Right. Yeah.
You can be convinced your mind to realize and still that what he realized was a fact, but came to the wrong. What's the solution to that then?
Right. Yeah. To sum up this portion, yes, Jim, you are correct. Jesus got what he actually wanted,
right.
But in some sense, I don't think that Jesus was pretending to not want to go to the cross for the sake of his hearers.
No.
I don't think that's what was going on.
Right.
I think some people actually like see things like, well, he was God pretending to be a man, so he had to pretend that he was tempted and pretend that he...
He did not pretend suffer. He really suffered.
Right, exactly.
In the flesh. Yeah,
at least in some sense, no, he didn't want to be whipped, brutally beaten, and brutally murdered.
Right. His carton did not want to be.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. Yeah, I think you can for sure say his flesh did not want to go to the cross.
Yep.
I would say even his flesh was willing. Whatever, yeah. I don't know how to answer all of the questions on it. But
yeah.
But yeah, that was a good point that I think I worded it in a probably not correct way.
Maybe just a little ambiguous.
You're right, right. And I do like to be accurate as much as possible. I'm not saying that I am or that I'm perfect, but it bugs me to hear people describing like either theology or Christianity or whatever, and they're just like, they don't really care about the exact accuracy of their words. Like, this is important.
Yeah, exactly. To the best of our ability and our understanding, we're really trying to say what we believe, and and we believe what we actually end up saying.
Yeah, right.
And we try to edit and fix it if it doesn't line up before we make it public.
On that note, so in this documentary that I was mentioning, another thing that they talked about, the hymn, the wrath of God was satisfied.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In Christ alone, I think.
Yes, I believe that's right, yeah.
And that's actually one of the few modern-day hymns we actually have.
Right. This one sounds like it could have been written 100, 200 years ago, but it wasn't.
Yep.
So, in Christ alone, who took on flesh, fullness of God in helpless babe, this gift of love and righteousness, scorned by the ones he came to save. Till on that cross, as Jesus died, the wrath of God was satisfied. For every sin on him was laid... Here in the death of Christ, I live. So they were saying that in this documentary that some progressive churches want to change.
Oh, yeah.
The wrath of God was satisfied to...
I mentioned that probably about 6-8 months ago.
Oh, okay.
I had heard it on a podcast.
Uh-huh.
Albert Mohler, he was talking about that. And
I see. Some progressive churches wanted him to allow them to change the lyrics or whatever.
In their version of their hymnal,
To say that instead of the wrath of God was satisfied, something the love of God was...
Glorified.
Something to that effect. They didn't want to talk about the wrath of God.
Right.
And the original author said, no, I will not allow you to change it. The guy in the interview, he said, He wouldn't even let him change just one of the words. Big deal. And I'm thinking, like, then why are you so upset that he wouldn't allow you to change it if it's not a big deal?
Right. Why wasn't it fine as is?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I've said this kind of thing before. Like, if it's not a big deal, then it's not a big deal. Why are you so upset about it if it's not a big deal?
Yeah, I just listened to that last night again, actually.
Oh, okay.
Stuart Townend is the original author of the song. Okay. Yeah, and he refused to give him permission.
That reminds me of another thing kind of along those same lines. I've seen Facebook posts and stuff of people saying, God does not send anyone to hell. We are already on our way to hell because of our sins, and God is trying to save us.
That's right.
It's like, yes, except for where it says, fear God, who after casting you into hell can destroy body and soul. I realize I'm quoting that wrong. Matthew 10:28, do not be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell.
Yeah, I mean, until he has the right and has the power. That phraseology for somebody to say that God doesn't send people to hell, he made a way so that you didn't have to go to hell, that does kind of, to say it that way, does challenge, depending upon if you lean toward Calvinism or not, whether that could be accurate or not. But still, I would say the spirit of the phraseology simply means, well, it does totally bump up against the predestination angle of saying whether you go to heaven or hell, that's already predetermined. And so, yes, it is him that sends you to hell if that's been predetermined.
Well, I don't really think it's a Calvinist versus Arminian thing or whatever. I think God does both. He wants to save you, and if you don't believe in Christ, he will cast you into hell. He does both.
But was he gonna anyway? To me, that's what Calvinism ultimately is saying, is that wherever you end up is because that's where God wanted to send you from day one.
Well, okay, yeah.
If you're predestining, you're predetermining either direction, which I get all the scriptures that sure make it sound that way. I have a personal hard time with that, not because we're powerful or because we're anything, and not because God can't do whatever he wants, as I've said before, but that doesn't seem consistent with what he's really trying to accomplish. But yeah, so yeah, that would rub up against that, though.
So yes, I get the spirit of what it's trying to do. How I really see it is, like, it's trying to make God not seem so mean.
Right.
God doesn't put people in hell. We put ourselves there by sinning. Like, well, that's like saying judges don't sentence people to prison. They put themselves in prison. Like, no, the judge slams the gavel down and says, you're going to prison.
Which is supposed to be based on your actions and the evidence
right.
that shows your actions.
Yes, it's your...
You did the work.
Yeah, you earned prison.
Right, right. Which we have all earned hell because we sinned against God.
Correct, correct. Yep. But I disagree with the statement, God doesn't put people in hell.
Yeah.
Like, God doles out the punishment that we have deserved.
Right.
He doesn't just sit there wringing his hands, like watching us go to hell and like, I wish I could do something.
Right. It's like, he did do something. He sent Jesus because he, as he says, he's not willing that any should perish.
Right, right. If you owe $1 million to your creditor and you're penniless and you don't have a job and you're disabled and you can't work, and say we live in a society where no, the law does nothing to help you, you know, you go to debtor's prison until you die. Say the creditor has compassion on you.
Yeah, there's a parable about that that
follows that exact
storyline.
Exactly, yeah. So the point I'm pulling from this, yes, this is almost straight from the Bible. Your creditor can forgive that debt by paying it out of his own pocket. That's what forgiving a debt is.
Right.
It's not making it disappear into thin air. It's paying it. Someone has to pay it.
Yes.
So say the creditor takes money out of his own bank account and then...
Jesus' blood.
Right. Anybody. And puts it onto the debt that you owe and wipes it out. But say you refuse, like, no, I don't want someone else to pay my debt. I'm responsible. I don't want to be a moocher or whatever. You know, there's people who, and to a certain extent, this is good, but sometimes people have too much pride to accept help.
Right.
I think that's what's going on when people reject the gospel.
Right.
They have too much pride to, like, no, first of all, they don't want to admit that they're sinful. I heard a guy say this in real life, an atheist that I know. He said, I'm not going to believe in some God that I have to rely on for everything. No, I can take care of myself. I don't need to rely on some God to help me with every little thing in my life. I earn my own money. I go to work. I can build things. I can fix problems myself. Like,
right.
Anyway, I'm going like way off of where I'm trying to get to with this. So say you say, no, I don't accept the help. And like, okay, fine. Then the creditor will send you to desert prison. Right. He's going to call the cops.
Right.
And say, go get that guy and bring him to court. He's not going to sit idly by while you right. put yourself into debtor's prison.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that's Matthew 18, verse 25. But as he was not able to pay, his master commanded that he be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and that payment be made. Debtor's prison. The servant, therefore, fell down before him, saying, Master, have patience with me, and I will pay you all. Then the master of that servant was moved with compassion, released him, and forgave him the debt. Is what God did. Mm-hmm. And the price that had to be paid for that, because it required blood, because it was sin against a perfect God, was the blood of his son.
And this is the other verse I was thinking of. Luke 12, 4 and 5. I tell you, my friends, and this is Jesus talking. If you read more context, you'll see that. I tell you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that can do no more. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who, after your body has been killed, has the authority to throw you into hell. Yes, I tell you, fear him.
Right, with a capital H.
No, I don't like the fact that God sounds like a big meanie.
Right.
But this is not...
But he did create everything, so he can kind of do what he wants.
Right. Plus, God is just.
Yes.
And if he's going to be just, sin must be punished.
Yep.
Either Jesus takes your punishment.
Right.
Or you're going to take it.
Right, exactly.
And God will dole out the punishment again.
Right, as I, and it'll take you eternity to pay it.
Yeah. The fact that God throws people into hell is not him being mean. This is a good thing. He's a righteous, holy judge.
Right.
Any judge that says, oh, you raped and murdered 100 defenseless little children? It's okay. You can go free.
Right.
I feel bad for you.
Right.
The punishment is too great. That judge is probably right. going to
lose
his job. And
might get some street justice.
Yeah, exactly. That's
executed on him. Yeah.
He might have a gang with pitchforks at his mm-hmm. door later that day.
Yep.
Because people know that justice exists and justice must be satisfied.
Yeah, that's right. Let's not pretend somehow God is not executing justice, because it also says he is just and he is merciful, and that in Jesus, justice and mercy kiss.
Right. Mark 9, 23 through 25. Jesus said to him, if you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes. Immediately, the father of the child cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. When Jesus saw that the people came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and enter him no more. This was the guy asking Jesus to cast out the demon to heal his son.
Mm-hmm.
And just this verse, it almost brings me to tears just like reading this. The father cried out and said with tears, Lord, I believe.
Yeah.
Help my unbelief. This guy was so desperate
yeah.
and so wanted his son to be healed. And Jesus said, if you believe, all things are possible. But this guy was struggling. It's like,
right.
I don't know that I have
right. if I have
this
it.
Belief that you're talking about, but I want to believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jesus cast the demon out.
Yep.
And I don't know, I feel like I have all these like feelings and emotions about this that I almost can't express. I don't know.
Yeah.
I love this verse so much. That Jesus isn't asking you to have 100% unwavering faith with no doubts. You know, like in another verse, he says, if you have a mustard seed of faith, a faith the size of a mustard seed, like mm-hmm. that's what I'm looking for. Like this guy knew, he said, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. I still have unbelief and I don't know what to do.
Right.
If that's where you're at, take it to God and right. give it to him. Give him your belief and your unbelief.
Yeah.
I just feel like I've been there and I've been in that place in the past many times and for long periods of time. And a lot of it was me just being so focused on my lack of faith.
Right.
If I had known that I could just take that to God and that that's what he wants.
Right.
I might have been not lived in that for so long. you know, part of me wants to measure, like, well, is it like, do you need 20% belief and 80% unbelief is acceptable? Or like, right. Yeah. I don't think it's not your level of belief or faith. It's, you can have so little faith and so little belief, but you want more.
Yeah. And you come to him.
Right. Right. And you come to him asking him. I've prayed many times, like, God, give me more faith. I don't have that much faith. I want more. And the fact that I'm asking God for it, it's like, that's right. What I want. That's showing that you have faith in God when you ask him for anything.
Right.
Whether it's more faith or forgiveness or healing or...
Right. There's nobody else that you can go to.
Right. And I feel like the way a lot of people talk about it or preach about it or teach about it is that, like you've mentioned before, like Jesus said to the disciples at times, you of little faith. And part of me has heard that in the past and God is just like super disappointed. You guys, I am just so disappointed in you. And like, you have so little faith. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, yeah. I don't know that that was Jesus' attitude when he said that to them. And this verse, I think, shows me like, yes, God knows we have little faith.
Right.
He's not mad at us for it.
Or surprised.
Or yeah. Surprised, right. Like when you see a 1.5-year-old trying to walk and he falls, you're not mad at him.
Right. Yeah.
You feel for him and you're like, oh, he's so close. Like, but like, then you help him up if he needs help up. Or sometimes you got to let him get up on his own. That's fine. But you're right there, like just anticipating the next step. And you're like, yeah, you did it. You took another step. That's awesome. Anyway, that's one of my favorite stories in the Bible. I said with tears, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief.